everyone the time. It's a Friday edition of the Mornings with Ed show, and thank you for being part of the program. Welcome today. Yesterday should have been just plain old ordinary January 6th, like it had been for the first 245 years of our country. That's changed forever, though. Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could, is the number one New York Times bestseller and a vital inside account of American democracy in its darkest hour. Our guest this morning is the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, member of the Select Committee on the January 6th attack, and author of that number one New York Times bestseller. Joining us for the conversation this morning is California Congressman from the 28th District, Adam Schiff. Congressman, welcome, and thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Ed. Great to be with you.
Great to have you today. I'm going to start right off with what I'm hearing this morning. DHS has said that in the last 48 hours, there's been an increase in online activity with threats targeting specific members of Congress. Has DHS been directly in contact with you?
Not on this occasion. I have had outreach from the Capitol Police and other police departments around the country with threats, sadly, from time to time, and a number of people have been prosecuted in federal court for threatening to kill me. But with respect to January 6th, while there was, I think, an increase in general threat reporting, at least as it pertains to me, I haven't heard any specific threats, I'm glad to say.
Oh, glad to hear that as well, then. I want to get to the title of the book, and it's going to lead to the first question out of the gate. And part of the title of the book is How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. And without sounding too dramatic, is the time between right now and the midterms, is this period of time our final stand for democracy?
I think it's a critical stand. I don't know whether I would say that it's the final stand, but certainly if the House were to change hands in the midterms, and I think it's probably a 50-50 proposition, and Kevin McCarthy should become Speaker. If he had been Speaker after the last election, he would have decertified the results in the House. Someone like that can never be allowed to be in a position of that kind of power and responsibility. So in a very real sense, democracy is on the ballot. And I'll tell you, Ed, one of the terrible realizations standing on the House floor yesterday in exactly the spot I stood a year earlier when insurrectionists were breaking the doors and breaking the windows to try to get into the chamber. The terrible realization for me was that we are in a worse off position today than we were a year ago, that our democracy is more fragile today because the big lie that drove that attack on the Capitol is still being promulgated by the former president and his enablers, and it's being used all over the country to disenfranchise people and to strip independent elections officials of their duties and give them over to partisan boards and partisan legislatures. They seem to be setting it up such that if they lose again, they can overturn the election more successfully. And so I think we have a window of opportunity to save our democracy, and we have to seize it.
And in mentioning Kevin McCarthy, we're also learning that members of Congress may have also played a role or were even complicit in the planning of the attack. How difficult would it be to subpoena either Jim Jordan or Kevin McCarthy's phone records?
Well, you know, we haven't reached the point of deciding what we're going to do vis-a-vis members of Congress, apart from having invited them to testify and so I can't discuss anything else we may or may not do. But, you know, I can tell you this about Kevin McCarthy, just to shed more light on his character or lack of character. There's a story I tell in the book that you'll be familiar with, sitting next to Kevin McCarthy on an airplane. This was some years ago where we had a conversation about who was going to win the midterms, very different midterms. I said the Democrats, and he, of course, said the Republicans, and it was a complete nothing of a conversation. We arrived in Washington and went our separate ways. He gave an interview to the press that night where he said that the Republicans were going to win the midterms. Everybody knew it, that he sat next to Adam Schiff on the plane, and even Adam Schiff admitted that Republicans were going to win the midterms. Now, this was years ago, before social media, and so I didn't find out about this until the following morning. And when I did, I was just beside myself, and I went up to him on the House floor, and I said, Kevin, first of all, for having a private conversation, I would have thought it was a private conversation, but if it wasn't, you know, I said the exact opposite of what you told the press. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I know, Adam, but you know how it goes. And I said, no, Kevin, I don't know how it goes. You just make expletive up, and that's how you operate, because that's not how I operate. But it is how he operates. He was really made for a kind of a Trump GOP where the truth is for suckers. And, you know, again, it just illustrates why the midterms are so important, and making sure that the speaker remains someone of character.
Right. We don't want the speaker to be a lapdog, which is exactly what Mr. McCarthy seems to be. And speaking of lapdogs, we found out a couple of days ago that Sean Hannity was sending texts back and forth with Mark Meadows on January 5th, directly refuting Mark Meadows' claims that absolutely no one knew it was going to happen, that they were blindsided. The committee sent a letter to Sean Hannity. Are we expecting him to cooperate?
I don't know. I hope that he will. He plainly has information very relevant to our investigation, very relevant to the events of January 6th and other events as well. You know, those text messages, including the one you mentioned, where he sounds alarm about what's going to happen in the next 48 hours, or others where he talks about the pressure campaign on Pence and how presumably, at least this is the import of the text message, the whole White House counsel might resign if they go forward. Now, that's what I'm reading from these abbreviated text messages, but we need him to come in and explain them.
Right.
And how he knew to be concerned about what was going to happen in the next 48 hours, and how he knew about what was going on, if he did indeed know, at the top levels of the Justice Department, that might cause the White House counsel to resign. We made it clear to Mr. Hannity that we're not interested in his political views or his commentary on Fox. He could say whatever he wants, but we are interested in him as a fact witness.
Right. And have you heard back from his attorney?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
At this point, unless they've had correspondence with our committee counsel that I'm unaware of.
Okay. The committee also wants to hear from Mike Pence. Now, assuming he won't cooperate, can you still get valuable testimony from Team Pence, the three Pence aides that are cooperating?
You know, I can't comment on who is cooperating or who isn't, but, you know, Pence, again, is one of those people who talk about a fact witness. He was the subject of this pressure campaign to get him to ignore his constitutional duty. The vice president's role during that joint session is a purely ministerial one. You count the ballots. That's it. And they were trying to get him to essentially throw them out from the states that Trump lost, the key states. And he refused to do so, to his credit. It may have taken the last days or weeks of his tenure to actually do something right, but he did. And he would be a very powerful witness about that. Failing that, there are other people around him that we hope will be cooperative and help and provide information and fill in some of the missing pieces. But we hope that he will do his duty as a citizen. And tell the Congress and ultimately the country what he knows.
And can he give full and complete testimony without compromising any future information from future vice presidents?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the current president has made clear that they're not asserting executive privilege, and that's the holder of privilege. If there are any security issues, for example, you know, where is the secure location or something like that, you know, we will, of course, work with the former vice president to make sure that those concerns are met. But the questions that we're most interested in about this pressure campaign and about what he knows about the planning for January 6th and the knowledge in advance of the likelihood of violence, these are things that that shouldn't be privileged in any way. And the current administration certainly is not asserting any form of privilege over.
Okay. You know, words and language are so valuable, so important, and something caught my eye in the book. In the book, you write that when you first spoke on the House floor in opposition to the challenge of the Arizona votes, you actually had to frame your argument using the word myth instead of the word lie. And I thought to myself, well, isn't that in and of itself a hindrance to the presentation of truth, that you had to soften it up for Republicans?
Well, You know, it's interesting you raise that because for a long time, early in the Trump administration, in the first few months, I really resisted using the word lie because it's such a shocking word to apply to a president of the United States. And it's also my experience that when you use certain language, you know, people you want to reach will just start to tune you out. But of course, you know, well into that first year of the Trump administration, there was no way to avoid using the word lie because he was so blatantly lying so much of the time. When it came to January 6th, in our planning meetings, and I had suggested to the speaker months earlier that we set up a small group to try to game out all the things that might go wrong in the election or the aftermath. And so I was one of the managers she asked to help organize the opposition. In her planning sessions, she made it clear, and I think she was right, that we ought to keep it very high level, keep it very, you know, at the level of history and ceremony, because that's what that day was supposed to be about. She didn't want it personalized to the president. She didn't want fights on the House floor and people trying to take the words down of others. If you call somebody a liar on the House floor, you can have their words taken down and it interrupts the proceedings. So she didn't want any of that to happen. I think she was right. But of course, once the insurrection happened and we went back on the House floor, then and they still were trying to overturn the election, then basically all the limits came off. And I remember one of the most powerful speeches that evening, that late night, and I write about this, was Connor Lamb, yes, of Pennsylvania, normally yes, very staid, very conservative, Democrat, very moderate speaking. But he basically said, shame on you for what you're doing, and called out the Republicans for the lies they were peddling. And it was really quite, it caused quite a verbal altercation on the floor. But I'll tell you, he put it exactly like it needed to be said.
Right. Sometimes the word lie is the perfect description for what's going on.
And in terms of the big lie, there's really no other word to use.
Exactly. If I myself defy a subpoena, I always imagined that I would go to jail. So I'm curious as to why not Mark Meadows. And in talking about Mark Meadows, would you ever consider giving him criminal immunity if he testifies?
Well, I think you're right. It's the expectation of most Americans, and it should be, that if you get a subpoena, whether it's from a court or Congress or any other lawful body, and you just fail to show up, you're going to jail.
Right.
And that would be true for any of your listeners. It should be no different for Mark Meadows because he was the president's former chief of staff. Now, we referred him for criminal contempt. We are waiting on the Justice Department to take the same action. We hope that it took with Steve Bannon and indict him. But in terms of whether we would give immunity to particular witnesses, I don't want to be specific to Meadows. We will consider that under appropriate circumstances where there's little likelihood that the Justice Department would want to prosecute that person. Our giving someone immunity to testify doesn't immunize them from prosecution, but it can make it more complicated for the Justice Department. So we want to make sure that we don't interfere with any plans they may have. And that gets to another important issue, which is, what's the Justice Department doing? And, I was heartened to see our Attorney General, Merrick Garland, the other day. He's a man of great integrity, and after 4 years of total misrule and terrible leadership by Bill Barr and Sessions, it was so refreshing to see a person of great character again lead the department. But I am concerned that I see and hear no indication that some serious potential criminality is being investigated, including the former president's effort to get the Secretary of State in Georgia to find 11,780 votes that just didn't exist, something that would have landed any of us on this call or listening under investigation.
Right. That brings me to the next question. That kind of arm twisting, searching for 11,000 votes in Georgia, if he chooses to pursue it, does Merrick Garland have a rock solid case to prosecute the former president?
That's a good question. That really depends on the evidence. And you would really need to develop the record. You'd need to find out, okay, what exactly did the president say? How many people did he contact? What did, Meadows played a role in this? What was Meadows' role in this? What was the role of other people in the administration? And there's undoubtedly not only a verbal trail, like that recording of that conversation, but a paper trail. Now, we are searching for, you know, the facts and circumstances about all these different lines of effort to overturn the election. But it's not our job to prosecute people. That's the job of the Justice Department. And, you know, Merrick Garland said the other day that they will follow the evidence wherever it leads. But he was talking about January 6th, and we can't take a narrow view of January 6th. We have to take the broad view of all of the efforts to overturn the election, any of them involving potential criminality. And they need to follow the evidence in Georgia to where it leads as well.
And I want to go to the book for a second. In the book, you chronicle step by step just how our democracy has been put at such great risk. I think my question is, why was it so easy? And was our system not prepared for a charlatan, for a mob boss to ever be president? Were there never plans for that?
There were plans for that. The founders really did contemplate that could happen. In fact, that there's that beautiful, terrible passage by Alexander Hamilton about when a person of no character who has got a military bearing, whips up the popular masses and, you know, rides the whirlwind. What a danger it could pose, and it seems like a prophecy of Donald Trump. But they did their very best to write a constitution that would constrain that person. And that constitution has worked well for more than two centuries. But it's not a guarantee. And one of the things we've found over the last several years is it doesn't matter how brilliantly the constitution is written. If members of Congress don't give meaning to their oath of office, if they don't give meaning to that oath with ideas of truth and right and wrong, none of it works. They couldn't protect us from, you know, the worst of ourselves if we stop believing in something called truth.
I'll close with this question, and thank you for that, by the way. I'll close with this question. Where do you see us a year from now or 5 years from now? Will we be 4 years deep into an autocracy 5 years from now?
I'm an optimist. All present evidence to the contrary. I think we're going to get through this. We're a really deeply resilient country. And there are millions more Americans who love and cherish our democracy than those who are trying to tear it down right now. But what we do in this moment will matter greatly. About how long it takes us to get through this. And the first test, and I hope it's not the last test, will come a year from now, or less than that, in the midterms. And whether we're ready to hand over leadership to a party that is now an autocratic cult of the former president, not wedded to our democratic institutions, not wedded to the truth. So this is a real, like the president said yesterday, Joe Biden, this is an inflection point. For our lives up until now, we've been moving in the direction of greater democratization. But there's nothing immutable about this. It's not a law of nature. We have to be willing to devote ourselves to our democracy to save it.
The book is Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. And I have a feeling that 50 years from now, it'll be valuable learning for students and for people who wanted to know exactly what's happening around this time. Our guest this morning has been the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and member of the Select Committee of the January 6th attack, Congressman Adam Schiff. Thank you so much for being part of the program this morning, and thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
Thank you very much. It's the Mornings with Ed Show, 8:20 the time.